The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora everybody and welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Well, today we're going into Climate Matters 136, and here's what it's going to cover. Nelson Hospital, a health upgrade the hospital didn't seem keen on. And then the carbon bootprint of war, we're going to revisit an item we covered in Climate Matters 72 when the Ukraine war was just starting. An item on Save Board revisited, and that's also an item that we touched base on about 2 years ago, I think it was. Worth a closer look, definitely. An item from the Can You Believe It files, A Tree That Rots. And Our World in Data gives deeper insights into food and climate. And a longer read, Now You See It, Now You Don't, Seeking Good Adaptation Policy. As I've found before, I don't always get through everything on the new Substack version, especially when we've got a longer read. Let's see how we go today. So, first of all, looking at Climate Matters 136, it was one of those where it didn't really have a theme. It had a lot of different items, but I think they were pretty interesting. The longer read covers the government's latest discussion document on climate adaptation policy, and it's a pretty jaundiced view that I've got on it. So anyway, we'll start. First of all, here's a quiz question. What is the oxalate carbonate pathway and what's its significance for climate? What is the oxalate carbonate pathway and what is its significance for climate? The clue is the answer will be in the From the Can You Believe It files. So if you remember what they were, that gives you a lead in there. Okay. Nelson Hospital, wider lessons from an overdue health upgrade for Nelson Hospital. And I'm particularly interested in this because I look right out at Nelson Hospital and where the chimney is or was. It's certainly good news, but it's long overdue. And after well over 100 years of burning coal, the Nelson Hospital has finally removed its big chimney and replaced coal with biogas, using methane from a council landfill. Yay, that's really good. And the methane is much better used for energy in the hospital than flaring it off at the landfill. And, of course, getting off coal is really good. We'll give a link to a Radio New Zealand episode on that. But, bizarrely, it's hard to see the hospital as a willing player, even though it's removing health-damaging pollution, removing an earthquake hazard, which the chimney was, and it's stopping coal emitting about 8,000 tons of carbon dioxide every year. That's a big deal. In 2023, in spite of decades of pressure from specialists and from community groups, 20 years after surrounding suburbs were placed under very strict air quality controls, I know I'm in those suburbs, and long after the chimney was identified as a seismic risk, the hospital was still applying to the council to renew its consent to burn 4,000 tons per year of coal, that is, emitting over 8,000 tons of carbon dioxide. And even with all those reasons, it seems, as far as I can tell, that they weren't going to do it until it took a hefty government grant in 2023 to turn the hospital around and get them to actually take down the chimney or switch, more to the point, switch off burning coal. Okay, I respect people who run a hospital. It's huge. It's intricate. It's a high-stakes operation if you think of people's lives being at stake and so on. But it still left me wondering just how many other health institutions might have management regimes that are also willing to exacerbate the very health issues that they're really there to fix. You know, there were a whole list of reasons why the chimney should come down, the coal burning should stop, and yet it took a big push from the government to get it there. And in case you're wondering about emissions from burning landfill gas, as against coal, yes, there's still carbon dioxide emitted. But first of all, biogenic methane is what's from what's called the short carbon cycle. So it's not a net atmospheric gain of carbon dioxide. And secondly, it would otherwise be flared at the landfill, as I mentioned a moment ago, because the worst thing that could happen is it's emitted directly as methane into the air, because methane has a massive heating pulse for a couple of decades after the methane is released. By burning it quickly, certainly it releases carbon dioxide, but in the first 20 years, that's only about one eightieth of the global warming that you get from releasing it as methane. So, good news, but strange that it had to be such a process to get there. Right, a quick reprint from Climate Matters 72 on the carbon impact of war. And with wars grinding on in Ukraine and horrifically in Gaza and in Iran, and now we're seeing a bit between Thailand and Cambodia, lots of readers have asked me, what are the climate impacts of war in terms of emissions and so on? So I went back and I reported on this in Climate Matters 72, March 2022, just after the initial Russian invasion of Ukraine. Tragically, from every angle, unless you're one of those people that still really think GDP is a good metric, it has only got worse. Why GDP? Because war is good for GDP, just like the Christchurch earthquake was, just like a car smashes. GDP is a crazy metric by which to measure the progress in our economy. Now, moving on, Climate Matters 72, I'm just going to read what we reported there. Calculating the unthinkable, the carbon bootprint of war. Apart from the human misery, destruction, and economic upheaval, war brings vast carbon footprints. The Intercept, we'll give a link to that, quotes a Brown University report saying the Department of Defense is the world's largest institutional user of petroleum and correspondingly the single largest producer of greenhouse gases in the world. Got that? The Department of Defense, that's the US Department of Defense. Forbes magazine, the business magazine, once reported an armored division, or a military armored division, uses up to 600,000 gallons per day of gasoline. That is about 2.3 million liters daily. Staggering. Guesstimating the Russian equivalent, they had at that time 190,000 troops deployed. I calculated that as about 10 divisions, 23 million liters of fuel per day. And that doesn't count the Air Force, and it doesn't count the other side. That's just the Russians. It's incalculable and it's unthinkable. Okay, I've got a quote here from Dr. Mike Joy. Many of you will know of him, a freshwater ecologist, very well known in New Zealand. And here's a short quote from Mike Joy. GDP equals greenhouse gas emissions, ergo more spending equals more harm. Ergo means equivalent to. So GDP, basically as GDP goes up, we're going to have that reflects more spending and that reflects more environmental harm, not just climate. Emissions are tied very closely to GDP, but also it's things like freshwater pollution and resource depletion and so on and so on. And here's a quote from Dr. Tim Morgan. You've heard of him before on surplus energy economics. This is from number 306. It would come as no surprise at all if the smartest corporations started to investigate privately the possibility that the economics orthodoxy is mistaken and that they might need to establish a leadership stake in a very different future. And what he's referring to there is, by economics orthodoxy being mistaken, is the mantra of constant growth and B, the measure using GDP to measure economic success. Right, jumping tracks. Take note, designers and builders, save board plus one, landfill minus one. And here's a save board is a remarkable product that's on the market now in New Zealand after a couple of years development. It is really, I think it's one of those cases where they've got the formula about right. I'm suggesting they're inviting a complete new mindset on how we approach it. Save board describes itself as not perfect, and that's because it has a slightly textured surface, but it's outstanding in so many other ways that I think we should look on that textured surface as a badge of honor. It's great to follow up the qualified tick that Climate Matters 75 gave Save Board in 2022. And this is, I think, a well worthwhile update, because at that stage I said I hadn't done due diligence on the product. And that at that time, Paul Charteris, who founded the company, and I discussed concerns I had about the need for independent evaluation of the product and the need to avoid greenwashing. And I have to take my hat off to him and to the company. They've gone to great lengths to tick a lot of boxes since then. The product range now sports six, quotes, environmental product declarations. They are often considered the gold standard of environmental assessment. They have a code mark certification. They've got credits with the Green Building Council. So when people use Save Board, it gives them extra points towards green building certification. They've even got a scheme that offers take back waste product. As long as it's clean product, they will take it back. So well done, Save Board, to tick a lot of boxes. In the hugely important quest for carbon negative solutions in buildings and for minimizing plastic waste, Save Board is potentially disruptive technology. Every square meter of 10 millimeter wall lining, so if you think of something like gym board and you think sheets of this product instead, a sheet of gym board is just under 3 square meters. So if a sheet of Save Board of the same thickness, 10 millimeters, would actually divert about 20 kilograms of waste plastic. And it reduces the carbon building, the building's carbon footprint by between about 10 and 30 kilograms of carbon dioxide in the per sheet. So really great. And it's a process that is made from compressing different sorts of plastic waste. For internal use, they only use clean, unused plastic waste, such as the ends of rolls of manufacturing, because that way it doesn't get tainted with things like food contamination and so on, which can give a slight smell, which is okay if it's used for an outside hoarding, but no good for an inside lining. So well done, Save Board. Okay, let's have a look at the Can You Believe It files, a tree that petrifies itself. And I'm quoting from the European Association of Geochemistry. We'll link to their article. It reports that certain trees, and especially some fig trees, use what's called the oxalate carbonate pathway. There we are. There's the quiz question. The tree draws carbon dioxide from the air. That's what all trees do. It converts it to calcium oxalate, and then specialized organisms in the roots convert it, in essence, to limestone. That's astonishing. And here's a quote from an article. The calcium carbonate is formed both on the surface of the tree and within the wood structures. And that's quoting Dr. Mike Rowley, who's a senior scientist at the University of Zurich in Switzerland. Carrying on the quote, this means that the oxalate carbonate pathway could be a significant underexplored opportunity to help mitigate carbon dioxide emissions as we plant trees for forestry or for fruit. Individual trees can form up to a ton of carbon-storing rock, securing carbon for far longer than, for example, the wood, timber wood, which obviously decays eventually and perhaps releases methane in the process. Great stuff. I hope we see more of that. And speaking of trees and carbon, Our World in Data produced an interesting piece which gave us further insights into the relationship between carbon footprints of protein-rich food. They've got a chart which shows all what I've called mountain ranges. For each food type, they've got a band that shows how much of it is high carbon, how much of it is low carbon, in terms of how many kilograms of carbon dioxide per kilogram of meat products or pork product or eggs or beans or whatever. Far and away, the greatest is beef, and followed by lamb, and followed by farmed shrimp. Now, that's not a big deal in New Zealand. Cheese comes next, and then pork is a bit less than cheese. Chicken and eggs are lower again. So then the best of them are, not surprising, the sort of vegetable products like tofu, legumes like beans and peas. Nuts are the absolute star. They can actually be carbon negative. To give you a bit of a feel for the range of carbon footprints, 1 kilogram of beef on average emits about 250 kilograms of carbon dioxide to produce that kilogram of beef. If you go to lamb, it's more like 200 kilograms, and you go to cheese, and it's more like 84 kilograms of carbon dioxide per kilogram of cheese. The eggs, chicken, and pork all sit in the range of around about 50 kilograms of carbon dioxide per kilogram. If we go down to beans and peas, they're right down at about 4 to 6 kilograms of carbon dioxide per kilogram of protein. And nuts incredibly save about 8 kilograms of carbon dioxide per kilogram of nuts. So how about that? Per kilogram of nut protein, I beg your pardon. So how about that? Anyway, carrying on from there, where is a decent adaptation policy when we need one so badly? And this is in response to the Independent Reference Group on Climate Adaptation issuing a report, an advisory report to the government. I'm not going to go into the deep dive. It's a long read article. I'm not going to go a long way into it. But let's just remember that climate change adaptation refers to actions that actually reduce our vulnerability to what might be coming at us in the climate way. So if you're doing something like lifting your house up a bit or building a seawall, they can be means of adaptation to protect us from the effects of climate change. But the trouble is that overall it's identified a real problem, and that is that the government can't forever be buying out people whose properties are inundated by either storms or subsidence or floods or whatever. But on the other hand, this solution just suggests that after 20 years, the government liability to anybody will disappear except in most unusual circumstances. It's been roundly criticized by very many people, including Professor Jonathan Boston, who's a policy expert at Victoria University, as well as being a very climate-savvy person. And he didn't mince his words. I'm quoting from a report of his, "One of the most philosophically misguided, morally questionable, administratively inept, and politically naive documents seen in years." I don't think you can say it much worse than that, can you? So I'll give a link to Jonathan's article. When you read the terms of reference that the advisory group was set, they were incredibly brief, but they also largely covered just two clauses, and plenty of devil lurked in the detail of those clauses. One was to ensure New Zealand adapts to climate change in a way that minimizes overall long-term costs, i.e. saving money is the main objective of the policy, not the well-being of people or anything like that. So point one, the second clause, which was under the heading purpose and scope, says the group is to provide advice specifically in relation to sectors directly impacted by climate change, including treaty partners, banking, insurance, and local government. Hello, insurance and banking are more directly affected than farmers with their farms covered in silt or householders with torrents running through them. It's incredible. Again, it seems to think that we can measure everything in money terms and then reducing expenditure is a worthwhile outcome. I was glad to see Dr. Belinda Story on the panel because I've referenced her. She's something of a guru in terms of climate impacts on coastlines and the like. But in the end, I think the whole report was very sad. It leaves the people who most need the help and are most likely to need it probably with the least help. There's got to be a better way. But one thing in particular that I have to highlight is what I've called a nauseating, overarching irony, and that is that many of the flagship policies of this current government overtly worsen the climate crisis. We can think of opening up oil prospecting and coal extraction. We can think of ending the clean car subsidies for electric vehicles. We can think of all of the highways that they're building that are going to promote more fossil fuel use. All of those things and more worsen the climate crisis. And yet here's the government saying we've got to save money on trying to mop up the effects of climate crisis instead. I think it's a very forked-tongue sort of document. Okay, we've reached the end there of this Climate Matters. Thank you so much for joining me for this. As you know, Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson-Tasman region on 104.8. And it streams to the planet on freshfm.co.nz and podcasts of Climate Matters and other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz and through the accessmedia.nz app. So on that note, this is Lindsay Wood signing off and thanking you for your company. I hope I have it again next week. And of course, as always, kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.